Welcome to Cartoon Creators, where we talk to the minds behind the shows that raised us. I'm your host, Tamar Lilienthal, and today we're talking to Eric Weiner, a legendary kids' TV professional who is the co-creator of the award-winning preschool series Dora the Explorer. Let's get to the episode. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today. I'm really excited to chat with you, really excited to have you on the podcast. And I think even though I guess your claim to fame is obviously being, you know, a co-creator of Dora the Explorer, I'd love to start off with what there is to know about you beyond Dora. Like, what's your story? What else have you done? And what do you do now?
I've, you know, slowly put the pieces of this together because they don't at first necessarily seem to go together. But I came to New York wanting to be a clown, a writer, and an actor. I don't know. I didn't know which order of those things. Wow. And then I was a temp typist for most of my 20s. I wasn't really doing anything to pursue these things. And a sister-in-law of mine got me a job at Scholastic News as the third grade reporter. And I loved it. But I had never done any writing for kids before that. One job led to the next. And then when I had kids of my own, which was right around the time I joined the development team for Dora, that changed everything because I, before that, felt like I was sort of making it up. I forgot what it was like to be a kid, certainly a preschooler. And then after Dora, I did Little Einsteins for the Disney Channel. And then took a long detour and wrote a novel that I'm glad I was not able to publish. It wasn't good. And then I started taking acting classes again and clown workshops and found that I loved all that as much as I had right at the beginning. And one of the things I took, then with COVID, I got back into children's writing and I've written a children's book series for Random House called The Famously Funny Parrot, Four Tales from the Bird Himself, and book two is in the works. But that doesn't take up all my time. And now that COVID has eased, what I'm working on right now is something to try to combine all those interests. And it's a storytelling project. I did a lot of improv at Magnet, one of the improv schools, and they have this wonderful storytelling teacher, Adam Wade. And what he's teaching is true stories. Strictly true is the rule. And what I worked on in there was a story about how I got into clown college as a teenager. Was incredibly excited, ran down the block screaming happily in the rain. My father, who was a professor of engineering and had been through the Depression, did not think that dropping out of high school to take an 11-week class in Lantana, Florida on how to be a clown. So we had a horrible fight over it, and I decided not to go. But this, what I've been working on lately, is sort of to combine all of it because it's storytelling, but it's faux autobiographical. It's including autobiographical elements, but it's really making things up, giving myself a different name, a la David Copperfield, as a signal that this is not all true.
Right.
And I'm looking forward to performing it for audiences, however small, because something I loved about children's television is the collaborative experience. And then maybe best of all, in the Dora process, the Einsteins, these fantastic research teams that you go out with, and now you have an audience of five preschoolers at a time. And that just brings the whole thing to life of why you're doing this. Same at home when I had preschoolers. You want to tell them, they want to hear a great story. So that's in a kind of a nutshell, a long, big nutshell. That's what I do.
No, that's awesome, though. That's awesome. Did you ever, now I was just curious, but have you ever kind of worked as a clown, kind of, you know, just purely as a clown performer?
No. And I guess I think in this storytelling mode, like I think I, when I look back, I think I was too worried about my defining my identity. If writing wasn't going well, really, what I want to be is an actor, and not understanding the basic thing that we're all a lot of things, and trying to combine them right now.
Right. No, that makes sense. That's super interesting. So then how did we, I guess my next question is how the idea for Dora came about, and especially, some of those kind of obviously all related but really diverse interests that you had. Like how do we get from that to the idea for Dora?
Well, I would say actually immediately what I think about is Chris Gifford, the executive producer, one of the three creators. He came out of children's theater and children's television as a performer. And it was a joke in our writing meetings that we would say, like, we wonder if we could convince Chris to get up and act this out, because he would already be up. And some of the key principles that he was teaching us in creating the show came from children's theater, like, tell them the answer, then ask the question. And I went home and tried this with Zachary, who was 5. And I said, Zachary, there's a ball in the tree, okay? If anybody asks you, got it. I wonder where the ball is. He's yelling, it's in the tree, it's in the tree. And the fun of knowing. But anyway, there was a lot of theater and clowning too, involved in the writer's room, certainly. Where the idea came from, we're often asked, and I bet it's true of all ideas, that it wasn't an idea. It was a whole evolution. It started with Brown Johnson was head of Nick Jr. at the time, and she put out a creative assignment to different teams. And the assignment was to develop a show about a girl who was a superhero, but who had no superhero powers. Which sort of makes you think, like, huh, what does that mean? What could that be? And that, I think, really did end up being in the DNA of the show, because we had developed it for a long time before Brown went to a conference and was moved by how badly Latinos were represented in television, how few good role models, and all of it. And she came back and announced that from now on, our main character is going to be Latina. And where we got to eventually from that, which was a suggestion of our head of research at the time, Valeria Lovelace, who had come from Sesame Street, make her bilingualism her superpower. Because what we found to our horror at the time is that kids who were bilingual and spoke Spanish and English were embarrassed and felt bad about the fact that they spoke Spanish and wanted to hide it. And so we wanted to flip that. Pat Buchanan was running for president at the time, saying, this is going to become a Spanish-speaking country, my friends. There'll be no more English. And so we didn't choose to do that, but then we were proud to have found ourselves, as part of that zeitgeist.
That's so interesting, because I was gonna ask you about that. I was a number of years ago writing a paper for a college class that involved Dora, and I found all these things about kind of the politics of the time. And obviously, as a kid viewer, I was not necessarily involved in that, but I was like, this is so interesting. I wonder how much of that was intentional or the creators were even aware of that Dora was kind of playing this role in that conversation. So I guess what you're saying is, it might have not been the impetus, but that you certainly were aware and kind of like were happy to have a role in pushing back against some of that rhetoric.
Totally. Well, and it was, Brown was in charge, and it came directly from her. Like, here's something I want this show to do. And I remember we initially, like many of the good ideas, that we fought it, because the three of us, it probably in today's climate would have been more problematic, but the three of us, Val Walsh, Chris Gifford, Eric Weiner, none of us was a Latino. And so it seemed like all those issues that we've gotten more into of who tells what culture story. We brought in a lot of consultants. We did a lot of research. We went on trips to Costa Rica and Mexico and other places. But the first time we went out with a story, I think it might have been like one of the very first times, there was a 5-year-old Latino boy, and you would have like a group of 5 preschoolers at a time. And the researcher holds up like a picture book version of the story and tells it. And then another researcher is leading them back to their class. And this boy turns and he gave me a look. And he's 5, and I could tell something was up. And he broke three and he came running over, and it moves me to even think about it. And he pointed at Dora and said, "That's me."
Wow. Wow.
So there were moments like that from early on where we felt like, oh, we did not, this was not our idea, but this is a wonderful thing.
Right. No, that's incredible. And I think, that I was going to ask, like, what was the public's reaction when Dora first premiered? Kind of what do you remember from introducing Dora to the world at the time?
Well, down the road, I'm like, there's all kinds of things that happened. Like during the time, I forget when this was exactly, but Arizona demanded to see Dora's birth certificate. She's an alien. We want her deported.
My goodness.
Nickelodeon responded, "She's a cartoon character." And that's all they were going to say.
Yeah.
But when the show first aired, we had done so much research and testing with hundreds of groups of preschoolers and made so many changes with the help of these brilliant researchers to see where we weren't on the preschoolers' wavelength. And it was this simulated interactivity where it makes it very easy to get a lot of data, essentially, because you're getting charts and graphs of how many kids are rowing along with Dora in the boat. Also, the feel of the room. We, at that point, when it went on the air, Chris said he'd never felt less nervous. Like, we know how this works. And the ratings were really high from the beginning, and the reviews were fantastic. So any kind of blowback certainly didn't happen at first. And I don't think it really ever has. I think she's been a good ambassador for, building bridges was one of the consultants' sayings in terms of our goals. We specifically created monolingual Spanish-speaking characters so that to act out that Dora could speak with them and she could speak with monolingual English characters, and look at that, she can. And she became a character pretty early on where we felt like she could go anywhere. And then we were thrilled that she pretty rapidly has spread all over the world. It was a wonderful feeling. I think we were so into it, and she was so real to us that we sort of felt like, look what Dora is doing. Like, she wasn't ours pretty soon.
Kind of took on a life of her own.
Yes.
Wow. And I think it's really interesting because you keep mentioning the kind of all the research that went into it, which I know from kind of working a little bit in the industry myself is not always a given, and everyone's got a slightly different approach to that. Everyone's got a slightly different budget when it comes to research. But it's incredible that you were able to do all this research at the time. Did that kind of like extend the timeline of getting the show off the ground? Was that a big kind of part of the preparation process that made it take potentially a little longer? I mean, it seems it was worthwhile though.
Yes, it certainly adds to the budget and it adds to production time. And then it would get it, where the budget would really come into play is if we, like Sesame Street, where Valeria had come from, there's a chapter that Nickelodeon made everybody read from the tipping point. And in their research, if they dipped below some incredible statistic of like 90% eyes on screen, just monitoring how much the kids are actually looking at the screen, they killed the episode. And we were in a very different position where we're like, it's 70%, guys, is there anything we can do? Because to kill an episode would really have set us back. And I can't remember off the top of my head if we ever had to do it. But so yes, it really does add time and expense. And then I think my sense was that because of the success of Dora, and because we were so into research, Christine Ritchie became the head of research and was so brilliant. that other shows were thinking, okay, we need research. For one thing, like I said, that it, because it's this simulated interactivity, it was a particularly, you know, it didn't feel subjective. You could really see what was going on. And for another thing, I think what often happens in at least in children's TV research is the researchers tempted slowly to start telling the creators what they want to hear. And Christine would say, nope, it's not working. Like we had a an episode when we were first testing it where Boots left the gate open and the three little piggies got out and Swiper the Fox was chasing the piggies. And this was new to us as you know, kind of a story. And the kids went so crazy over it. We thought, wow, we have a big hit. And Christine said, they know they are, because they would take them privately and have them point to a strip of faces from, you know, happy all the way to furious. They were all pointing at furious. And they were starting to tell things like, I'm going to go home and tell my parents to get another lock on the door.
Oh, wow.
And what Christine was saying is we were asking preschoolers with this simulated activity, it was very real to them. Dora's always saying, I need your help. So here she's saying, I need your help. And it, to them, if a fox is chasing a pig, it's to eat it. Like they know that sort of archetypally in their bones and from stories. So now you're asking a three-year-old to save the day and it's just not fair.
Yeah.
So she was saying we had to either come up with so what can we do? She said, come up with some kind of a fig leaf to give them to hold onto for what Swiper's trying to take, other than the pig himself. Otherwise, you're going to have to kill this episode. And we gave them blue ribbons for being such good piggies and kept saying, wow, Swiper's going to take their ribbons. And preschoolers would repeat that back to us, you know, in telling the story back to researchers. He really wanted their ribbons. And it sort of lived on the edge of very exciting, but not scary.
Right, not terrifying. That's so funny. That's so funny. And it's so incredible how kind of, you know, you come up with something that makes total sense and plays out one very specific way in your brain. And then you kind of test it and it's like, whoop, they got a very different message out of that one. It's super interesting.
Well, I'm remembering now, like on Little Einsteins, where we imported the whole research technique and everything.
Yeah.
We had an episode that, at least at the beginning, there was an animal of some kind stuck in a tree at the bottom of a volcano, and the volcano was going to erupt. We thought, well, this is very high stakes, and it wasn't working at all. The only thing that kids were saying, they kept talking about the bananas. We didn't even know what bananas we were talking about. There were bananas in the tree where the animal was. They were worried that the bananas would get ruined by the lava.
Oh, my goodness.
And it meant that we had not succeeded, you know, in getting them to bond or identify with this animal character at all. But
right.
They instantly cared about those bananas.
Right. Who would have thought?
Or on Dora, Leslie Valdez was our script coordinator at first, and then he wrote for the show. And he pitched us an idea. He came in and said, you've got this character Boots. What if he loses one boot into the river and they have to get it back? And we were like, I don't know. That seems kind of low stakes. And Christine was always saying about things that she saw had potential. Well, let's try it. It was what we would call a rock concert. They went nuts. And what Christine was saying is like, that's a big deal to lose your shoe to a preschooler.
Right.
They got it. That didn't require volcanoes and lava.
Right.
But it didn't, you know, when Leslie pitched it, we thought like, okay, big deal. You lost your shoe.
Right.
It's so hard to go back to age 3, 4, 5.
Right, for sure. Which is where it kind of makes sense, some of what you were saying at the beginning about how having your own kids kind of changed things a little bit for you. I feel like I work with a lot of people who say the same thing, that, you know, it's hard when that age group is not kind of in your face, you're not interacting with them regularly. But a lot of my coworkers who have young kids, who have preschool kids, start to kind of have more real-time feedback on certain things,
yes.
You know.
Well, group one, we used to always feel sorry about group one of our research, because we would take out the story, group one, and then tell the the preschool, don't send any kids in for until we tell you, because group one would always, they'd be so excited to hear the story just because the researcher said she had a story to tell them. They were thrilled. And then they would start pretty soon fall on their backs. They would beg to go back to class, and we would be so far off. And then often the preschool teacher or the kindergarten teacher, when we were leaving, would be telling a story to her class, and they're enthralled. And to your point, I mean, they were working with these preschoolers that were all day long, every day,
Right.
and they knew what worked and what didn't. In fact, one teacher said to us early on, she said, "Can I give you a note?" She felt embarrassed because, like, oh, we're the TV. She knew much more about preschoolers than we did. She said, and at that point, she said, "You're saying I need everyone. I need everyone to." She said, "That doesn't work. You have to say you, and everyone feels like you're talking to them." She said, "If I say I need everyone to go to your chairs, nobody goes." And that's a crucial little difference.
For sure. For sure. Wow, that's so interesting. So, I mean, Dora has obviously since the first iteration of the show taken on really a life of her own. Like you said, I think that happened pretty instantly, but all the more so over the last couple of years with all the reboots, films, spin-offs, even at the time the Go Diego Go spin-off, but then these like live action movies aimed at older age groups, and now she's coming back to Paramount Plus. What do you make of all of that? Do you like all the different iterations she's taken? Do you think it's a bit much? Do you watch them even, if I can ask that?
I don't watch much, and I think this was a problem I had as a because I was a co-creator, a co-producer, and the head writer. As a head writer, a weakness I had is I just wanted to write it myself. I wanted to, and so I was I think I wrote the first maybe like 22 of the first 26, and Nickelodeon made me start, you can't write them all. But I know how I can feel like, oh, I would do it differently. And everyone does do it differently. So I haven't really liked the feeling. It's great that she's had these spin-offs and success, but that it's sort of having lost my direct connection to her,
Right, for sure. I can understand that. I mean, in general, this field is obviously one that's like any creative field is, but particularly in a field like kids TV, it feels like something that when someone makes something, they really pour like all of themselves into it. So yeah, that definitely makes sense. So I mean, looking back on the experience now, I mean, is there anything that you would have done differently? Is there anything that you're really proud to have done in that project, an approach that you would like recommend to others? What are kind of your go-tos of this was great and this is something I would have changed?
The number one thing that always comes to my mind, and then I have since, forgotten my own advice, but really, I think it was research that made that show a success. And so I see movies where I think, couldn't they do some kind of story testing with adults? Because I see story principles that we learned with preschoolers that are probably the same for adults that are getting violated, and I can feel it as an audience member, like, ugh. And Valeria, when Chris brought her from Sesame Street, she said she was really tired, not of working with preschoolers, but with the writers who were, she would come back from the preschool and they would say, well, she would say they didn't understand this, and the writers would say, we're children's writers, we know what we're doing. And so she said she would only do it if I committed to going out with her and seeing for myself. So I think the thing, Dora was, I think, criticized by some, like, oh, you're doing too much testing, like somehow it's bad if kids understand and are, identifying with the show. I never understood that. I guess it was find some way would be my advice to anybody, no matter what it is, to interact with your actual audience and the development of it. When we would go out, wait for groups to come in, I would pull books off the shelf, to get inspiration and ideas. And sometimes I would read these things and I think, wow, that feels so preschool. Like, how did the writer know this? Invariably, then you read about the author, they're going around to schools and reading the book over and over again as they write it, or they have children at home. There's a new hit series, which I'd like to read, this book series, something like Phantasmagoria. I forget the name. And there was a big article about its success in the Times. And she had kids of her own, and that was what it was inspiring her. And when they aged out of the group, she immediately set it up to, she needed her audience, and she continued to develop the books with target audience, go out there and read to them. So I don't know about proud of it. It was the most meaningful part of the experience for me. And it was something that we really did, we got it right. Because over and over again, we became less and less skeptical of the research because they would give us these graphs. And then, for instance, Nickelodeon's animation was out in LA. And so we wanted to show them the research process, which they were so annoyed by. They were getting all these strange notes. And we tested an episode that we tested here, which was a Christmas episode that was testing well. And then they could match up the graphs. And kids in California, kids in New York City and all the different boroughs, identical. Identical responses with little cultural things like in California, kids when telling the story back would say that Santa lived at the North Pole. But basically, it was reproducible. It really was real. It was so I that kind of connection with the audience, I really loved. And writing, I've loved writing these children's books. It is removed. COVID added to it, to the isolation, but fiction writing in general, it's a you write it, then they publish it, someone else reads it. It's so non interactive. And that's something that I miss.
Well, that's super interesting. And sounds like that really was an incredible process, all that testing and kind of working with preschoolers that went into it. So I think I'll close this out with a last question. I mean, I'm curious, and this is kind of separate a little bit from the Dora piece, but I'm curious, who is someone in within the kids' TV realm that you looked up to at the time, kind of as you were doing Dora, Little Einsteins, like who were the people inspiring you then, and what excites you now? Who are kind of current creators that excite you?
I think at the time the show that inspired me the most was Blues, not Blues Clues, Teletubbies. Teletubbies, Ann Wood, that British show creator. It was the first show, which was controversial, aimed at 0 to 2, which in terms of what pediatric advice is not so good to get, shouldn't do that. But the simplicity of it, that the confidence that, like, to have a bunch of Teletubbies sitting around a hole and we all just wait, and then a rabbit pops his head out and they all go, ooh. I thought, my God, this is genius and clearly totally clued into her audience. She apparently created that show because she wanted to make preschoolers feel comfortable with technology. So she put the television in their tummy and they liked the vacuum cleaner. I think it was called the Nunu. Turns out preschoolers are way ahead of us with technology. But then it led as a sort of story starter to this magical world that she created. I think she's amazing. And Dora, yeah, back to your question about where the idea come from. My first big idea from seeing my kids and computers and the computer games, what if this is the show that introduces preschoolers to computers? We were all excited, and so there was the things like the cursor arrow and all this stuff was coming out of it. And then one of the consultants came in and said, "Guys, you know what you need to introduce a preschooler to a computer? Let them sit down at the computer. In about 10 minutes, they're more comfortable with the computer than you'll ever be." We don't need a show to do that. But Ann Wood, I've heard about, I haven't seen some of her other shows, but they are wildly different and imaginative, and I think she's amazing.
Look, I mean, she said that that's another show that, I think initially got a bad rap and like what's the point? But you kind of watch its success. And I remember a mentor of mine once saying to me, like, people think it's very easy to write for a preschool audience, to create for a preschool audience. Like, no, it takes a tremendous amount of, smarts and technique and all of that. Because they're not just like little kids who will, just be glued to anything. Like they have brains too. And it takes a certain level of skill. So I think I definitely agree with that. And I think that, Dora was a part of that as well. I think that that's why so many people, myself included, found myself glued to it. So
Teletubbies, interesting enough, was aimed at 0 to 2. When Nickelodeon, they were shopping it around, who wants it for America, which ended up being, a gold mine for products.
right.
Nickelodeon researchers in general don't want to test with younger than 3 because then they have to change diapers. So they wouldn't. They tested with 3 and up, and it bombed. And they said, "Don't buy this show," because it was that specifically aimed at her target audience.
That is so interesting.
That, I guess, and then in Britain, people got stoned and watch it. That's a whole other demographic.
Oh man. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for sitting down with me and chatting. And it's been really, really incredible to, hear about your experiences creating Dora. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for tuning in to Cartoon Creators. We would love if you connected with us on one of our social media channels. Have a comment, question, or an idea for a guest we should bring on to the pod? Email us at info@cartooncreators.com. Both words starting with a K, of course.